Mumbrella's Sports and Entertainment Marketing Summit takes place on the 7th of April 2022 at Royal Randwick Australian Turf Club, bringing together the best of sports and entertainment marketing sectors. Get access to both conference streams, great networking opportunities, and exclusive social events. Hear from industry experts from DDB, OMD, the brand builders, and more as they tackle the biggest opportunities, challenges, and trends for the year ahead. Purchase your early bird tickets now and score $100 off. Head to mumbrella.com.au/sports-entertainment to redeem your savings.
Hello, this is the Mumbrella Cast. I am Damien Francis, and after hosting this Mumbrella Cast for over a year, I finally discovered I don't have to start it with "Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast." It has been one hell of a wild ride. Joining me this week on the wild ride in Australian media and marketing, managing editor Olivia Krimmel.
Hello, Damien.
And Mumbrella Cast producer and self-proclaimed Mumbrella Melbourne Bureau Chief, Callum Jaspin.
Hey, Damo.
Later on, Cal is going to talk to Simon Lee, partner and executive creative director at The Hallway, following his Boys Do Cry mental health campaign this week. The conversation will touch on how the campaign idea came to life.
Of course, one of the key kind of unwritten, unofficial commandments of masculinity is that boys don't cry.
Why the creative industry might face issues of depression and anxiety at a higher rate.
Rejection. Constant and consistent rejection comes part and parcel with the territory. For every one fantastic idea that gets up, there's 50 where you have poured your heart and soul into this thing and someone just puts up their hand and says no.
And how his personal experience helped him encourage others to speak out.
I've been sat there about to present something with sweaty palms, that odd sort of almost out of body kind of feeling sitting there. And occasionally I have found myself going, gosh, I wonder if anyone else in the room here is actually feeling this.
Before we get there though, it's been a busy week in the media sector in particular. Cal, what's the Mumbrella Cast menu for the day?
The first item we'll be discussing today, Damo, is Roy Morgan delivering its total news readership figures alongside new figures on magazine readership. And we'll also be discussing what went out as a Dr. Mumbo on Monday regarding Seven's reported $1 million interview with Adele, which went south pretty quickly when it apparently came to light that the interviewer, Matt Duran, had not listened to the artist's full album.
I've heard the first rule about Dr. Mumbos is you don't talk about Dr. Mumbo. That dad joke, that too early for the dad joke,
I haven't heard that rule. Maybe that's...
My apologies.
The rules being kept to properly.
Moving right along. The Sydney Morning Herald this week retained its spot as Australia's most read news brand in a new total news figures from Roy Morgan. The figures, which include print and digital news, reported the Nine owned publication being read by 8.7 million Australians based on the last 4 weeks averaged over the 12 months to September, up from 8.4 million in August. Sister newspaper The Age was second with 6 million, while National News Corp title The Australian followed with 5.7 million despite being behind a hard paywall. This is the second set of statistics released since the Emma metric was dumped by Think News Brands in April this year. I personally have always had a little bit of an issue with readership figures, if I'm honest. It's pretty easy to argue that it was one of the least scientific figures possible. Way back in the day, 2013, in fact, co-founder of Mumbrella, Tim Burrows, wrote an opinion piece on that note questioning readership figures of magazines that looked like they were 10 times their circulation, which was quite the number. Personally, I remember working for publishers where readership was just casually around the 5 times circ figure. Obviously, it's a lot more complex now. Digital is a big play. The big question in my mind, and I'm going to point to you on this one, Cal, is how are these figures being calculated?
Yeah, so the figures are compiled, first of all, by Roy Morgan Research, which, as we know, became the sole provider for the total news metric earlier this year. And then they supply those figures to Think News Brands, which is a kind of a body whose stakeholders are, as we know, Seven West Media, Nine, and News Corp. And then they will subsequently decide whether or not or what they want to do with those figures. So I spoke to the CEO of Roy Morgan Research just before, Michelle Levine, as well as Howard Seckham from Roy Morgan, as well as Vanessa Lyons, who runs Think News Brands, just before we came in this podcast. Getting the full scope of how those figures are put together, it's kind of twofold. The first and kind of main stream for that is they speak to just over 1,000 Australians per month, and that's a kind of survey type deal. That's the same as they've been doing for many years. So that's about 60,000 people per year, and then obviously those are kind of either face-to-face, or now it's a bit more hybrid with COVID and things like that. And then the second stream of that is what they call a digital panel. The official title is a web audience measurement. So that's sort of VPN, which people who sign up for or agree to do it will put on their computers, and then Roy Morgan can kind of passively observe what they do online. And that's a kind of, you know, viewpoint of everything they do online. And there is about actively at the moment 3,500 people that are doing that. So I guess that is a much more, obviously a smaller sample size, but it's a much more accurate way to look, because as they told me, I think it was Vanessa that told me this, that the survey, I guess similar to what we have spoken about previously with the way radio figures are compiled, they're not super, super accurate. I mean, they are accurate, but people have a bit of difficulty remembering that high level of detail. So it obviously does make you, you know, you wonder. You are extrapolating these figures, and that's 60,000 people over the course of the year, extrapolating that to what we have, about 25 million in Australia. But the other interesting thing is, you know, with this total news figure that we're now working off, Vanessa said, what, you know, we have these questions. For example, one that's been brought up this week was the AFR, which was, I believe, about 3.5 million readers. You're not using the traditional metrics of print readership and then people reading an article on the AFR website. What the figures now include are what they call direct and indirect readership. So you've got on-platform and on-platform, probably in more simple views. On-platform are what you would kind of imagine as being someone reading the AFR or going onto the AFR's website and reading an article. But then off-platform, which is, I guess, something that is more important now, the digital news readership has kind of become the dominant way that people are reading news. And that's through things like Facebook, Google News, Apple News. And that's all included in these total figures. So for example, you'll get a notification on your phone and it'll say, you know, whatever the news headline is, and you'll open that. And it might give you a couple of paragraphs. And then if you want to keep reading, you have to either go to that website or you have to pay for the subscription. But quite often, it has the listed example, for example, if it's The Age. Roy Morgan do have a partnership with Apple News that they're working with. So, you know, you do get some of these kind of freemium type articles. So I think what the two stakeholders in this process, Roy Morgan and Think News Brands, were saying to me is that I think a lot of people have questions right now over those metrics, but it's about kind of changing the perception for what those total news figures actually include. And that is that kind of direct and indirect, off and on platform figures that they're now working on.
I think changing the perception is a really good segue into my next question, which, I mean, look, everything you've just said it's quite complex. There's a lot going on there, but one of the big issues with measurement and readership in particular that's been plaguing the industry for quite some time is trust. And this is the big issue that Emma had. And obviously Emma is sadly no longer with us. But one of those, the issues there was that not enough people were trusting in those figures and actually using them. And again, Mumbrella has covered this many, many years ago about the amount of people, or amount of media agencies who are actually using them letting Emma help dictate their strategies a bit, and the end results in that were not very many. So I think the next important question here then is, you know, trust from the buyers, Cal. Is there trust? Do people believe that this is a good metric to follow and base strategy on?
Look, I think, and I'll try not to waffle on so much on this answer, but I think basically the impression that I've got is that It's all the industry has. They're currently, Roy Morgan is the sole provider for news readership figures, and I think
I hope your answer is going to get better than it's all the industry has.
No, but I mean, speaking to Sam Giffray from Cara in Perth, he's the group investment director there. He said that the move to ditch Emma this year has certainly provided a positive shift for the industry. As it now brings clarity to all the parties involved, be that the agencies, the advertisers, and the publishers, with one total news figure rather than multiple from different sources. For agencies in particular, he said that it allows them to precisely plan their campaigns better, as well as making better informed investment decisions for their clients. And Steve Allen from Pyramid Media also told me that Roy Morgan is generally seen as a high quality supplier, not just in terms of news figures. So I think you're working with a pretty trusted source there, and the sample size as well being that kind of 60,000 per year. As far as, you know, extrapolating a figure, 60,000 is a pretty decent size. On the AFR, he also, you know, this is the one that a lot of people have been talking about this week. He noticed that
quite
not
questioning,
everything,
really, right?
What was that? Sorry,
questioning the AFR figures, right?
Yes, exactly. So, but what he kind of noted was that not everything is behind a paywall on there, but you know,
and just for listeners out there, the readership figures of 3.5 million thereabouts, if I'm correct, for a publication behind a paywall.
But look, and as you say at the start, there, you kind of joked that they do have confidence, but again, there's not really much choice but to have confidence, or not confidence, but trust the figures, because that's all you're working with. Clients do believe they're getting good value based on the figures that they're getting. And this is, as Steve said, for some clients, news is the be-all and end-all. And for that kind of on-platform news, the figure for investment is still about 50, it remains about 50-50 between digital and print actual investment. Liv, I think you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this situation, it is, you know, Damien joked about it, but actually it is the best that the industry has at the moment because of the stalemate between the Interactive Advertising Bureau and Nielsen with regards to their digital content ratings, which have not been released by Nielsen to the general public. They're only released to each individual publication because of a stalemate with the IAB over the integrity of that data. Obviously, the IAB is about to switch providers in that they're moving from Nielsen to Ipsos in Q2 next year, or it's scheduled for Q2 next year. So I think we'll have to wait and see what happens there as well, because if you've got the, you know, the real independent measurement system, i.e. IAB and Nielsen, not being made available, and then obviously the industry body's data is being made available, not surprising that they would want that data made available because it's controlled by them. So I think we will have to wait and see what happens next year once Ipsos and their measurement systems are up and running to really get a better understanding of what exactly the behaviours are in Australian media with regards to particularly digital news websites.
And that, just quickly, that was what Sam said from Cara. He said, look, we do trust these figures, and it is showing the strength of and the power of print and digital news still. But again, it's a small sample size based on since we've had that switch, and so we're probably going to need a few more data sets to then make an accurate kind of assessment of things.
Moving on to the next big story in Australian media, we'll be speaking about Seven and the big money interview that was withheld. One of the biggest stories of the week has been that of the botched interview of singing superstar Adele by Seven's Matt Doran. It emerged that Sony had exercised its right to withhold the interview, part of a bigger deal between Sony and Seven, when Doran revealed during the chat with Adele that he had only listened to one song on her latest album. Doran was allegedly suspended for the incident, although there are conflicting reports about what actually went on, with Doran being quoted as saying the interview actually ran long at 29 minutes as opposed to the 20 that was scheduled, despite Sony deciding to withhold it. It's another PR challenge for Seven and also provides an insight into how celebrity interviews are negotiated. Liv, there's a few different versions of the story flying around. What do we know so far?
Yes, there are. And it's, when the news becomes the news, poor. I do feel sorry for Matt. It's probably not how he envisaged this interview to go down, becoming the story instead of becoming the guy who nabbed this great interview with Adele. But there, the main things that seem to be coming through, and again, there is a bit of hearsay in all of this, although he has spoken on record to a number of publications about what happened. But basically, it does sound like he missed an important email.
We've all been guilty of that.
We have all been guilty of. So, not the biggest crime in the world. But then, obviously, it's come to pass during the interview that he hasn't listened to the album, which I think we at Mumbrella were very quick to compare to this scene in Notting Hill where Hugh Grant is at the interviews with all the celebrities of the new movie and he has no idea what it's about. So can only imagine the horror on poor Matt Doran's face when Adele asked him about the album and what he thought of it. But yeah, essentially it seems like he missed the email. He hadn't listened to the album. He got through most of the interview and then that came to light. And then at some point after the interview, the Sony executives decided not to release it to Seven, which I think for us in the media sector raises a few other more important questions. Firstly, the fact that Seven spent all this money, a reported $1 million, although some sources have said it was less than that. But you've got to wonder how it is that they could spend that sort of money, even if it was just under $1 million, on something that actually hasn't come to light. And then I think the other really important thing is, where's the editorial integrity? Because if Sony is controlling the actual footage and filming and recording of the interview, even though Seven sent people over there to do it, how can anyone ask any kind of legitimate questions when they don't know that they're actually going to get the end result? And I think that's the more important thing to come out of all of this for us in the media. And I think it's probably a good lesson for a lot in the media in terms of how and when you should allow these, agents or brands, or in this case, obviously her label, to control that much of the editorial process. So it's definitely brought up some very big questions for Seven shareholders and for media buyers. I think the more important thing would be, what's happened to that money now. Obviously, Sony's probably pocketed it and yet Seven has got nothing for it. They got a stitch together special because they couldn't even get the Oprah interview. So it does just leave a lot of question marks around the operations and the integrity of Seven in regards to having these sort of interviews lined up with celebrities and with these kind of, parameters around the interviews, which they're paying a significant amount of money for.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think you've got a really good point there on the editorial integrity, and it's something that, I think if journalists are honest, we've been talking about for quite some time, particularly in different sectors of the industry, former tech journo here And I think it's one of those sectors which it's very easy to start asking questions about the integrity and the brand input there and the control that brands and their agencies have over the process when it comes to some of the exclusives and some of the interviews that are lined up and some of the, I guess, press that certain brands end up getting and exclusives that end up running. And, you know, interestingly enough, then it's followed by advertising and things like that. It's quite a murky area. And I think you're right. It's one that needs more discussion. You mentioned the shareholders and the investors. Look, do you think there's really going to be any significant lasting effects on Seven, perhaps its relationship with Sony, on the ASX at all? Or do you think this will be something that, you know, in 2 weeks it's going to have blown over, we'll have all forgotten it ever happened, Matt Doran will be back on Weekend Sunrise and the world will keep turning?
I think it will, definitely, but I think it does also just contributes to an overall kind of situation for Seven that they've had this year. And look, it was raised at the AGM and, you know, Seven, unfortunately, this year has seemed to have quite a few situations where they've become the news instead of just covering the news. So, you know, earlier in the year, we've had the whole Katie Hopkins debacle with Channel 7's Big Brother VIP. You know, she got evicted from the country before she had even been let out of hotel quarantine. We also have had Seven and the whole Ben Robert Smith because of the legal fees and that obviously that ongoing case that he has against Nine Entertainment Co. and its publications for coverage and defamation. They've now got a new defamation case with regards to the incorrect identification of a man in regards to the missing little girl Cleo in WA. And then they had the social media post, the racist one that they, you know, made a apology for, an official apology for, following the Euro football tournament. So it does unfortunately feel like out of all the big major networks, Seven just has had a string of bad luck this year. And I think that will weigh on the minds of investors and shareholders when they're looking at how the company is being run and the editorial decisions, et cetera, that they're being that are being made. At the AGM, someone did question why James Warburton was being paid a base salary almost as much, or I think maybe even slightly below what Mike Sneesby is on at Nine, even though Nine is worth significantly more in terms of market cap than Seven. So although, yes, this will blow over and I'm sure Matt will be fine, his career will continue to prosper, but it just it contributes to an overall situation for Seven.
Well, there certainly haven't been many journalists shy of an opinion over the last few days. We all seem to like throwing a stone inside a glass house, but regardless, we'll move along quite quickly because coming up next, Cal will be chatting to The Hallway's Simon Lee.
Simon Lee, partner and executive creative director at creative agency The Hallway. Welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the reason we have you on today is due to the campaign that yourself and The Hallway released on Monday in conjunction with University of Melbourne Centre for Mental Health, Mental Fitness Foundation, Gotcha for Life, Eris Films, with support also from Unlimited, an initiative centred around encouraging men to speak up on dealing with mental health and anxiety. It's a take on The Cure's classic hit, Boys Don't Cry, reworked into a 30-man choir singing Boys Do Cry with lyrics written by yourself. Is that correct?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
So I think a good place to start would probably be how the campaign came together. I know, I understand it was a 3-year journey from start to finish. So it would be interesting to get your thoughts on just, you know, from the starting point up to, you know, Monday morning's delivery of the video.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, before we sort of go into that, first of all, it's extremely exciting to finally see this campaign kind of go out into the world and the response that we've had so far in the first few days of the campaign has been super, super positive. And I and all of my team are hugely grateful for everyone who's getting behind it. So in terms of how it came about, as you say, it was a 3-year journey, and it started really, I was sort of coming out of the back of quite a difficult period myself. And as I was coming out of that period, I picked up a book by the British artist Grayson Perry called The Descent of Man. And I was reading this book, and he describes in it what he calls the ministry of masculinity. And the ministry of masculinity, that of course it's an imaginary thing, but it's this notion of a whole series of unofficial, unwritten rules of masculinity that the vast majority of blokes unconsciously adhere to. And when I was reading about this, it was a real sort of light bulb moment. And I'd always thought of myself as a pretty sort of emotionally kind of able kind of guy, but as I read this, I realized that absolutely I too am bound by these commandments. So it's, you know, it's classic sort of things that you know, things like don't be vulnerable, keep your emotions to yourself, when the going gets tough, man up, be strong, get on with it, all of those sorts of things. And of course, one of the key kind of unwritten, unofficial commandments of masculinity is that boys don't cry. And as I was reading this and starting to want to do something about this, I was sat in a room with a couple of colleagues and throwing around some ideas, and that's when we hit on this idea of transforming boys don't cry into boys do cry. And that really was the most single-minded way of doing the job that I thought needed doing.
And then obviously from there it transformed into what is now this campaign, and it's being released as an official song. You got sign off from The Cure's frontman Robert Smith himself. Did you initially have an idea as to, you know, turning that into the video that it was 30 men singing from all these kind of, it was quite, I guess, emotive in the way that, you know, you've got men from all walks of Australian life in there kind of representing the wider population.
Yeah, look, it went through a whole number of different iterations over the 3 years. The only thing at the outset that I was certain of was that transformation. And then, of course, from that point, there's a whole number of steps that you've got to go through. The first being actually, can we get permission from Universal Music and from the Cure to use the lyrics? So there was a presentation to those guys that was a really important part of the process. Of course, the writing of the lyrics themselves, that was an interesting one. You know, I am a writer, but I've never really written songs before. I've written some pretty bad poetry, and I've written a lot of scripts of varying lengths. And I was sort of sitting with Charlton Hill, who's a good friend of mine over from Uncanny Valley, who is actually a singer-songwriter, and he'd been sort of with me since the beginning of this project. And he said, "Mate, look, I think we're getting to the stage where we've got to write the song." And I kind of nodded, you know, kind of hoping that Charlton was going to write the song. and then I was like, "So who's going to do that, Charlton?" And he's like, "You are." I was like, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, you go and write the song." So I was actually about to head off on a trip to visit family back in Europe, and we were staying in a little cottage in the Welsh hills, and I kind of just locked myself away for a couple of days, and out flooded these lyrics that have remained pretty much unchanged since I first wrote them. So we got the sign off then, approval on those lyrics from The Cure, but then of course you basically just got at that point. So we had a song, but we didn't have any money, we didn't have anything beyond that. So we then went through a fairly lengthy period of trying to chase funding to make this thing happen, And the way that ultimately came about was just fantastic sort of synchronicity, I guess, that one of the other things that were a big inspiration for this project was Gus Warland's Man Up documentary series on the ABC. And someone had pointed me in the direction of that show. So I was watching that at home, and I found myself literally in floods of tears watching this one scene in particular where Gus's son and his schoolmates are sat kind of basically learning to express their emotions in front of their classmates. And it was hugely emotionally powerful, but it also really gave me hope that change was possible. And it kind of made me even more committed to trying to make this happen. And to cut a sort of a long story short, probably as long as a year after I'd watched that show, I got introduced to Gotcha for Life by Rachel Troy at Unlimited. So it was just mm-hmm. after the first Sydney lockdown, and Gus Warland and the producer of the Man Up documentary, Jennifer Cummins, came into the office here at the hallway, and we had a fantastic meeting. You know, Gus was really enthusiastic about the project, and he said, "Listen, mate, I think we can help you guys make this happen, and I'd love for it to be in partnership with Gotcha for Life." So that was a key piece, and then through Jennifer Cummins, she had the very strong University of Melbourne connection, and that was kind of one of the final pieces of the jigsaw to actually get this thing going. And then from that, it was about really getting great creative partners on board. So we were absolutely delighted when we had conversations with Sam Long at Good Oil, and they were committed to it from the outset, and brought Tom Campbell, the director, on board, along with a whole crew of people there. We shot it back in, I think it was in May this year, and the shoot day was incredible. It was a hugely moving experience. Walking up the road towards Marrickville Town Hall where we shot, and hearing the song being sung, in rehearsals by this choir. I've got to admit, I did. In fact, there were a lot of tears shed that day by a lot of people involved, and I was one of them.
Yeah, I've seen comments on Twitter and such with people saying just watching the video they've kind of teared up. I think the kind of imagery of having it in that kind of the community hall setting, which is commonly associated with these kind of meetings or support groups, which I think for many men or I guess the wider population is also a first step in kind of acknowledging your own struggles. And I know it's something that you've had your experiences with, and this is partly why you've spoken about you wanted to address this. And there's some figures in I think that the University of Melbourne Centre for Mental Health put forward, and they're saying that around 3/4 of suicides are by men, about 7 men take their lives each day in Australia, with they've also been the leading cause of death for Australians between the age of 15 and 49. It's obviously a really important issue, and something that maybe isn't spoken about, but more specifically in the ad industry, I think it is another thing that really needs to be touched on, because doing some research for this, I looked back on some figures from an industry survey last year that reported that around 56% in the ad industry in particular experience symptoms of depression annually, and 52% have expressed anxiety, with around only 6% thinking that their company anonymously was addressing mental health effectively. Do you think that there's something specific about the ad industry that maybe these numbers are particularly higher than the more general population?
I don't know the sort of statistics across other industries, but obviously I have been working in the creative industries around advertising and film for just over 20 years. And the thing that I would say is that I think, well, in my own experience, I've realized that there's been times in my life where my sense of self-worth has been hugely tied to my professional and creative achievements. And I think one of the things about working in the creative industries is that rejection, constant and consistent rejection, comes part and parcel with the territory. For every one fantastic idea that gets up, there's 50 where you have poured your heart and soul into this thing and someone just puts up their hand and says no. And you know, when you're a junior, that's really hard to bear. As you become more senior, you get a thicker skin, but I don't think it ever really goes away. I think to do brilliant creative work, you have to invest yourself personally and emotionally in it. You absolutely have to. All of the best work has got people's souls souls within it. I think for anyone at a point, that sort of rejection, that is your rejection of your idea, but because there's so much of you in it, it is, and it can feel like a rejection of you. I can absolutely see how that can be tied to mental health issues, and it's certainly, you know, when I was going through a hard time, I have no doubt that was part of it.
And I guess now is a really important time, because we do see a lot of these initiatives coming out of agencies kind of speaking about mental health. Anecdotally, I've had people in the industry say to me that maybe these come without the acknowledgement that part of it is caused by the workplace itself. Do you think there is a responsibility from the agency to kind of help people deal with their own mental health and kind of, you know, be maybe a bit more honest about the causation itself?
Look, I think to stand up and go and say agencies need to take more responsibility for their people's mental health is a very big statement to make. And I think within that, it sort of suggests that they're consciously not taking that responsibility. And I don't actually think that is the case. I think that on the whole, most people and most leaders in this industry are absolutely concerned about their people's mental well-being. And if they become aware and conscious of the fact that there are issues, then they will then I would like to think, and I might be naive, but I'll persist in being optimistic and thinking that people do want to change it. But I think the best thing that we can do is kind of what we're doing here right now, and it's just talk about it. It's talk about it and just normalize mental health issues. Like, I have sat in meetings over my career where I've been sat there about to present something with sweaty palms, that odd sort of almost out of body kind of feeling, sitting there, and occasionally I have found myself going, gosh, I wonder if anyone else in the room here is actually feeling this. But when you're caught up in it, you're convinced that they're not, that it's just you. It's just you who's there kind of with your mind racing, freaking out, wondering what's going to come out of your mouth when you stand up. The reality is it's not just me. It's not just you. It's a lot of people at a lot of times in their life. And I think it's just about being totally honest and open about it, unburdening ourselves of our individual sort of dirty little mental health secret. It's like, no, this is being human. So let's be cool with that, and then do whatever it is we need to do to address it.
Do you think it's as simple as just talking about it? Because I know that people who have been, you know, in the industry for multiple decades and haven't maybe had that experience or haven't had to maybe address it, it can be quite a tricky topic to talk about. And, you know, now we've got this opportunity with almost a full reset, people coming back to offices and maybe in more hybrid ways. But I do feel like maybe, you know, things like hybrid working hours. It seems like there was steps taken during COVID, but then, you know, a young creative I was talking to last week, she was saying, I was in the office till 10:30 at night, and then I was back in at 7 a.m. And that, you know, is something that kind of damages people's mental health, because you can, it can lead to burnout and things like that. I think there has to be maybe some sort of acknowledgement that it for some it might be harder to do, but obviously it's essential to actually get talking about it, as you say.
Yeah, look, I'm not when I say that talking about it is, you know, is key. That's not. I'm not saying that that's easy to do.
Yeah,
but and I don't pretend for a second to have all the answers as to how we deal with it. But one of the things, as you were talking, that sort of came into my mind is the fact that none of us have any issue sort of calling up and telling our manager or what have you that we're not going to come to work today because we've got a cold, or we've got a, you know, you've got the flu, or you've got some kind of physical ailment. But I think there is still a taboo and a discomfort about calling up and sort of going, you know what, I'm really struggling mentally today. And so I think it's creating an environment where that conversation becomes okay, and that we have people within our agencies who are then trained to be able to respond in a way that can help that person. So that, you know, if I am calling up going, you know what, I'm really struggling, you know, I'm super anxious today, that the person I'm talking to can actually come back and go, okay, well, you know, do you have the support? Do you have the support that you need? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And can guide people in the right direction to potentially come out of that positively.
And I think just finally, because obviously the campaign is focusing on the struggles that men have in speaking out about their own struggles. Do you think that there's maybe still a sort of disconnect in the way that men interact with each other in the advertising industry, in terms of, is there still barriers in place there in the kind of work culture that maybe prohibits that?
Yeah, absolutely. I will be going, I think in a week or 2 weeks time, I'll be sitting at the the campaign brief legendary cocktails thing with a whole load of creative directors and what have you.
And we can be promoting rival events on our
sorry about that, but that is going to be, you know, that is where there's a whole, and it's not just guys. There's been big efforts made to change that, but there will be a whole load of leading male creatives there, and the sort of sense that you get is a bunch of super confident, super successful kind of guys. But I can absolutely tell you that within all of those people, this is a whole load of creative people. Creative people are prone to these issues, that there will be people sitting there, but that is absolutely not what we'll be talking about. There'll be a lot of creative bravado, laughing, a lot of banter, a lot of joking, and not much beyond that. And I think that is actually, an example of how blokes still are. And let's face it, there's still got to be a place for that. We're not advocating or suggesting that we're constantly, as blokes, having deep and meaningful conversations and pouring our hearts out. No, sometimes we do just want to, you know, have a laugh. But it's knowing that when you need it, you can go beyond that. And that's some of the work that Gotcha for Life is doing, which is fantastic, around actually identifying in your network who are the people that you can actually download with, that you can actually kind of express your feelings to. And that's one of the things I feel really lucky to have, you know, two or three mates who I know that I can talk to them about absolutely anything. And just knowing that I've got that network is great.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, as you say, it comes with the acknowledgement that, you know, not everyone is the ideal person to speak to, but the importance of having or identifying those people is a great starting point.
Well, Simon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, and congratulations again on the campaign.
Mate, absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
And that's it for this week. We are done for another 7 days. Liv, Cal, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks, Damien, Damo. And happy birthday to you both for the weekend.
Woohoo.
Saturday, best day of the year.